Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Teiba, a food writer and a director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from our studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli and supermarket, but what is beyond the sushi? We hear dashi, ramen, izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Andrea Vazzari, who is a Tokyo-based photographer in travel, portraiture, and the culinary world. And Andrea just published a fascinating book called Tokyo New Wave, The Next Generation of Tokyo Chefs, 31 Chefs Defining Japanese Next Generation, from 10 Speed Press. And it's actually coming out on March 13th. And we tend to think that Japan is dominated by traditional Japanese food, but it's full of global restaurants throughout the country. Andrea is one of the few people who have captured the real Japanese dining scene in that sense. So today, we'll discuss the latest of the restaurant scenes in Japan and chefs in her beautiful and insightful book, and which also includes recipes, by the way, and her unique experience of living in Japan. But before we start, Japan Eats is available on the Heritage Radio Network, a website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and now Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. And also, if you have any ideas about topics of the show or show guests, please let us know. And you can email us at japaneats@heritageradionetwork.org or akikotema.com. Now let's start our conversation with Andrea Vazzari. Hello, Andrea. Welcome
Hello.
To Japan Eats.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
So I'm very excited to have you here.
Thank you. Me too.
So first of all, where are you from?
I am technically from New York City, but it's hard to say that I am specifically from here in a way because I love to travel and I've lived in a lot of other places. But technically, I'm from New York City.
Okay. So welcome back.
Thank you.
Right. So you have a very impressive resume before you became a photographer. And
Thank you.
Worked at Dolce & Gabbana.
Yes.
As a PR manager.
Yes.
And Miramax Films.
Yes.
So do you think the experience as a PR person has affected your current career?
No, absolutely. I think everything before this moment has molded me in some way or determined the way I am now. And working in fashion was a very creative field, even though it was public relations. It's a very visual, creative field. And I think it served me well as someone who notices a lot of things that other people don't notice, someone who loves the visual world. Mm-hmm. And also my experiences meeting people, famous people, especially because I did celebrity services. That was part of my job. Also taught me a lot about humanity and how the world works. And working in cinema, which is also a very visual field, I think they both led me in some way to ultimately be a photographer and now also writer and author.
Right. And I wish our listeners can see you because you look amazing.
Oh, so, you're so very kind.
I can tell
Thank you.
From fashion
you're
business.
You're so sweet. Thank you.
So now that sounds like it's related to photography to be in that industry,
yes,
right?
Yes.
So how did you become a photographer in 2003?
It's a bit of an intricate story. It happened a little bit before that. But basically, I was in Paris at a shoe design school. I had left the fashion world and Miramax Films. I had left them. Mm. And I thought that perhaps it was fashion design that I was more interested in because I didn't feel that fashion in the PR world anyway, public relations, was something I wanted to continue with. It felt didn't feel authentic to me. Mm. I thought that for my career and for my future, there had to be something else out there. So I enrolled in a shoe design school. And while I was in Paris, my father fell quite ill. And I got that cinematic call in the middle of the night saying I had to come to New York. So I came back. And while I was here, there was a Travel and Leisure magazine on a coffee table at my parents' apartment. And I picked it up and I was just looking through it. And I noticed that I felt a mixture of sort of nervousness and anxiety looking at the photo saying, oh, I could do that. What? I want to do that. And photography was a hobby. And while my father was slowly improving, I decided, you know what? I'm going to call Travel and Leisure and see if I can get in there to speak to the photo editor. So I called, got the photo assistant. He answered, and I basically said, hello, my name is Andrea Fazzari, and I'd like to learn how to become a photographer. And after calling and calling, and he called me back, he finally gave in and said, sure, can you come in tomorrow? So I got along so well with the photo editor, and to make a long story short, he said at the end of the interview, how would you like to work for me?
Wow.
So I learned a lot about photography with that photo editor, and I was sent on assignments, and I also met another photographer who would then become my boyfriend for many years, and we traveled the world together taking photos and shooting for magazines, and it was a lovely time.
Mm, it's amazing. Maybe your father saved your
career. I think
career.
The universe made it a bit dramatic, but yes, it put me on the path that is much more, that I'm much more comfortable with. I'm much happier as a photographer and author.
Right. Mm. And persistence works.
It's true. When you listen to that little voice, when something also affects you in that way physically, I think you have to take notice.
Mm. Mm. So you didn't go to school to study
photography? No, I did not.
Wow.
I'm self-taught, and I took one course at ICP many years ago when I was just out of college, and because it was a hobby, as I said. And then I was self-taught, and also traveling with my then boyfriend, who was a photographer. Mm. I observed things with him when we would shoot together, and I learned a lot about light with him.
Wow.
So that's how it happened, really.
Mm. Mm. Right. So it sounds like photography is not just capturing images. It's so much beyond.
No, it's a lot about feeling and emotion and light. Mm-hmm. To me, it's a very emotional occupation.
Mm. Mm. So that makes sense that you published a book, which I'm going to talk about in
yes.
a moment. So, so you have traveled 80 countries as a photographer, and you lived in Italy, France, and Hong Kong, and of course Tokyo. And so, why are you interested in the world outside?
You know, growing up, my mother especially was very keen on fostering an interest in the world in myself and my sister. She was very interested in travel herself. And when we were very young, she and my father would take me and my sister out of school to go on trips. And I remember the first time I went to Europe, I was 7 years old. And I've always had this outward vision, and it definitely was fostered by my mother in particular, I believe. And I always felt excited, curious, and interested, and very satisfied when I was on my trips. Like, mm-hmm. wow, the world is so fascinating. And the cultures, many of them were technically foreign, but felt very comfortable and familiar to me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like an addiction. I love to go and to go to places I've never seen, and obviously to return to some that I have seen and visited. But it's a very satisfying experience to travel, and you learn a ton, which you could never learn if you stay in one place.
So you learn from people usually, or how
languages, or
the experience, like, you know, you can see the nature. That's an experience.
Sure, that's a different kind of experience, because that is perhaps more solitary. I think that is also rewarding. I think my experiences that have been more rewarding for me personally are interactions with other people, definitely,
right.
In other countries. Tons of heartwarming things, which I remember often and I carry with me through life. things and experiences that I've been exposed to that have meant so much to me, that have been so honest and true. And that notion of what is authentic is what you find when you travel. And there's a lot of beauty out there, even though today I know things seem difficult in the world. Mm. There is a lot of beauty out there.
Right. Well, I'm very curious about, you know, how you get so deeply into the culture, because, you know, like I said, having publishing a book 3 years after living in one country is amazing.
Yeah.
So you just, you know, say you go one place, you break a conversation with somebody else? Or how?
Well, to tell you the truth, about Tokyo New Wave specifically, I did not move to Tokyo to write the book. Mm. I moved there on my own volition, my own desire to live there, because I first experienced Tokyo and Japan in general when I visited approximately 18 years ago when my sister and brother-in-law were living there and my niece was born in Tokyo. Mm. Excuse me. And from that trip, I was changed forever because there was something about it that was simultaneously foreign and quite familiar, as if I knew it already. Who knows if in a past life I was Japanese? I don't know. Mm. But I felt fascinated and comfortable, and I couldn't wait to get up each morning just to go out and explore. And so I wanted to return one day. I vowed I would return to live in Tokyo one day. Mm. And I lived in other places and finally made the decision almost 3 years ago now to finally move to Tokyo, and it was a fantastic decision. And I honestly started going to restaurants. When I first arrived on, I remember January 5th, I went to Ryugen, which is a very, very famous 3-star Michelin restaurant, Kaiseki, very formal.
Seiji Yamamoto.
Yes, exactly, right. Who's wonderful. And then on January 6th, I had a reservation at Den, which is Zayu Hasegawa, who is amazing and who has a whole different vibe and philosophy, which is fresh, young, very happy, very gregarious.
Okay, so before you get there in the book, because I want to get into those details, so you decided to move to Tokyo for the sake of...
Because I loved it and I decided it was time.
There's no assignment or anything?
No.
Wow.
I just picked up and went.
Really? So, but then you found a job as a freelance?
Well, as someone who works for myself, I have many different clients, so it's a little bit flexible. I can move and still get assignments and do projects no matter where I am. Yes, I had a boyfriend at the time who I broke up with and decided it was time to move to Tokyo.
Yeah. Right. So the first your father and then the next boyfriend.
Well, the boyfriend, I knew it was time to go and it was not the right situation. So, but that just showed you how much conviction I had that it was now, it had to happen. Mm. So the reason why I was bringing up Den already is because you asked me, how is it that I was able to publish a book so quickly? Mm. I started posting photos on Instagram of my chefs, of the people I was meeting, just for fun, for me, because I love food and food culture. To me, everything radiates from food. Mm. Politics, culture, history, anthropological issues for me are incredibly juicy and fascinating. So I started to think that this would make an amazing book. Mm. So about a year later, a little bit less, I wrote a proposal and sent it to publishers, and they responded.
Mm. Okay. Right, because I was going to ask you why you became kind of specialized in the chefs and food world.
Well, I've always had a special interest in food and food culture throughout my career as a photographer. I have been a travel photographer, but I have I tend to gravitate toward food and food culture. So my first food assignment had been with Gourmet many years ago. You remember Gourmet magazine, which was a beautiful magazine, and I shot a lot from that for them, and they sent me on some wonderful and memorable assignments all over the world. Mm. So it's just a personal interest that I like a lot.
So food as a subject, as an image, as well as a representative, you know,
of a culture.
Yeah.
Yes. I think, as I said before, everything emanates from food, or everything comes to food. You could say it both ways. if we talk about food, we're also talking about farming. We're also talking about politics. We're also talking about society. We're also talking about design. We're talking about language. We're talking about ceramics. We're talking about so many things. So for me, food is really at the core of everything in life.
Right. And we are made of food.
And we are. We are what we eat. It's true.
So, okay. So now let's talk about your book. And so your new book, Tokyo New Wave. Yes. The next generation of Tokyo chefs.
31 chefs defining Japan's next generation.
Sorry, yeah.
Yes.
First of all, what is the is this book about? Like, you know, whoever has no idea what it is. Like.
Well, Tokyo New Wave is about this generation of young chefs that are representing Tokyo and its food. Essentially, that's what it is in its simplest form. And a generation is technically 20 years. And so the youngest person, the youngest chef in the book is now 30 years old. The oldest is probably 44, 45. And I decided to keep it within that range. And I also wanted to represent and show what's going on in Tokyo beyond the traditional, as you said in your introduction, beyond sushi, although there are also sushi chefs in the book, beyond yakitori, although there is a yakitori chef in the book. I wanted to also represent the chefs doing Italian food, French food, and mixtures as well, and doing unique cuisines that are literally creations that only they could have created. It's hard to stamp them with a label. So Tokyo is incredibly vibrant, and it is much more than Japanese cuisine. But so I included all of that in this book. The 31 chefs are a great mixture of many different types of cuisine, including what, you know, the many different Japanese cuisines.
So whenever I see Japanese chefs who cook French or Italian, or they have the same mentality as sushi chefs. It's like a pursuit, in pursuit of perfection.
Yes.
And they try to preserve the tradition where they learned pasta making in Italy.
Exactly. They're extremely good at detail and precision. That's one of the reasons why I also wanted to live in Japan. The detail, the attention to detail is something that is unparalleled in the world. I believe Japan and the Japanese are masters at of observation, to tell you the truth. So some of these chefs, yes, they went abroad and spent time abroad, and they came back to Japan changed, personally quite changed. And I address those things in my introductions, my my interviews as well. And that personal transformation is extremely fascinating to me as well, beyond just the food itself. What they learned abroad and what they brought back, and then how it's manifested in their restaurants, in their food, but also in the hospitality, the service, and the design, the atmosphere.
Right. So I think the mindset of Japanese chefs, regardless of the category of cuisine, it's more like I think they really dip themselves in.
Yes,
the genre.
They do. They submerge themselves completely or immerse themselves completely.
Right.
Absolutely.
Okay. So the book says new wave, Tokyo new wave. So what do you mean by new wave? Exactly?
Well, this generation is the new wave. They're different in many ways from their predecessors. I believe as a whole, they are much less rigid, much less mysterious. They're much more open to the world. And I think a lot of that has to do with the changes that all of us are feeling in the world now, social media, the use of Facebook, Instagram. I think these are really changing the society in Japan as well. And I think that a lot of them are very open, in addition to other cuisines and using other things they've learned by traveling, because also many of these chefs have traveled a lot more than their predecessors or the previous generation. And this has changed their food.
Right.
No question.
So
that's what New Wave is.
Right. Yeah, I think like chefs conference, which is, I think, also.
Yes, there are a lot of conferences now. Many of the chefs in my book are frequent attendees of these food conferences around the world, and they embrace the world now a lot more, I believe, than the previous generation, which preferred, to stay in Japan.
And also presenters, too.
Yes.
Right?
Absolutely.
And I did actually a translation for Seiji Yamamoto's audio.
Oh, you did?
And it was so novel and so... It's not that it's hard to translate. It's hard to understand the concept. Like, yes. What is he talking about? Yeah. So, but it was fascinating. Once you understand it, it's like, well, this person is something else.
Absolutely.
Right. So, okay. So the book is full of those chefs, but mm-hmm. I had to pick 31 chefs. So yes. How did you do that?
I did it in many different, there were many different factors. I'd say the biggest factor was purely feeling and emotion. I noticed how I felt when I was dining at the restaurant, any given restaurant, or how I felt in the company of the chef. I also looked at basically what the person was doing, what the chef was doing. Was it interesting? What aspects of the personality in front of me were fascinating or unique or interesting for a reader or for me personally? Were there things about the particular personality that were heartwarming, some sort of personal story which I wanted to share with the world? Because also delving this deeply into a chef's personal life and personal way of thinking is very unusual for a book about Japanese chefs. So I was keen on working with people who were willing to open themselves up to me. And some were much more open than others. And I excluded some chefs whom I had met purely because they were not open to me. Mm. They would not allow me to photograph them in certain situations because I have included many photos of the chefs outside of their restaurants, not in the kitchen. So I wanted to show a bit of personal life, and some didn't want that. I excluded some chefs for seemingly not being interested or interacting with me very much. And I felt that I wanted to essentially partner with chefs who were very excited about the project. So the chefs that I've included in the book, I feel have something to say about Tokyo, and I think they are valuable for conveying the soul of a city. And in that way, this book is very anthropological and very different. It is not a cookbook in the traditional way at all. It is a book about chefs and their lives and my personal interactions with them, and it happens to have some recipes in it. Mm. So I wanted to express through my words and through my photography what Tokyo has been to me. And it's a fresh take on the city, which I think is very interesting to share with the rest of the world.
Mm, right. And actually, the images outside restaurant is mm-hmm. too so refreshing.
Yes.
To see. So
I wanted to show them as people. Right. Not just in chef whites or whatever outfit they do wear. They don't all wear chef whites. But I think this also brings a fresh intimacy and humanity to the depiction of Japanese chefs and Japanese culture. Because in the West, people are still mystified by Japan. They find it to be either difficult or confusing or so remote. And I feel that this book shows these chefs as very relatable personalities.
Right, right. And then your text is full of your feelings about them. And I really enjoy reading.
Oh, thank you. That means a lot to me. I've had such a... In large part, Tokyo has touched my soul.
Mm.
And I think that this book is a love letter to Tokyo in particular, Japan in general, but Tokyo specifically. And I've been so moved there. And I've had so many experiences which affirm life, not to sound hokey, but this is also why I've traveled for so many years as a photographer, because it's so beautiful, and it explains essentially why we're alive and what this life is for. Mm. These experiences with these chefs as representatives of a faraway place that has become my home means a lot to me. And putting it on pages and publishing it and making it available for everyone to see is like a huge hug in a way and a way to convey what I've been feeling.
Right. So maybe the what you're feeling from Tokyo, it's a lot of energy, but it's not in positively way. Positive way is like to me, New York City is chaotic and out of control, and I love that. Mm-hmm. But in Tokyo, there's some like wave direction of energy, like waves.
And yes, and also I find Tokyo, although it's also double the population, if not more, than New York City, I find it to be quite peaceful. Mm-hmm. And sure, if you go to Shibuya, it's crazy, but there's still this overriding sense of, you know, organization, you know, that precision and that everything is on time and everything works well. And that is very refreshing. Mm-hmm. It's nice to live in a country where everything works super well. But beyond that, the warmth and the sort of acceptance that I've encountered there and has been very counter to what so many people think of Japan. So I find myself spending a lot of time contradicting people's ideas of Japan and Japanese people, because they always say, oh, but they're not warm, they're cold, they're detached, they're not like the Italians. You know, that's what people say to me. And I say, just wait a minute. Not everyone expresses themselves, you know, the way an Italian person would. And just because someone is not overtly very ostentatious or with their feelings or very forthcoming or immediate with their feelings doesn't mean they're not feeling them. Mm-hmm. And you just need to step back a minute and take some time to just observe and not judge and wait, because also you need to be patient in Japan. People take longer to trust.
Right.
And even within Japan, even Japanese to Japanese, you can say more to me about that, but I've noticed that it's not just with foreigners, but even from other people from other parts of Japan, with like people from Tokyo, people in Hokkaido, it takes a while to foster a relationship. But once you do, it's there and it lasts.
Right. Yeah, I think there's an assumption. It's like, you know, lifetime employment kind of mindset. Yeah. But I also think, you know, the immediate cheerful reaction to people is not always regarded as valuable.
Right.
In a way, it's kind of subdued manner.
Yes, and much actually, more reserved.
Yeah, and actually doing things, considering how you're feeling in a quiet manner is more relevant in Japanese culture.
Yes, it's just different. And I think tourists have wonderful experiences when they go to Japan, but some tourists are also perplexed. I think they don't understand. But it's wise to just maybe read about it or try to understand it better and not judge so much, because the Japanese, I'm here to say, are very feeling people, and they don't need to be like the Italians. We'll leave, you know, the Italians are great as the Italians, but we'll want something different for the Japanese.
Right. Yeah, like you, something, you know, like good in restaurant service, they don't seem to be paying attention to you, but that they do.
Japan?
Yeah.
Like, oh, my gosh. Oh, I was just telling you before we started the show that most Japanese chefs most definitely have eyes at the back of their head. They feel things. It's a lot more about subtlety. And, you know, there are some difficulties, like the use of silence in Japan can be very difficult to understand. And I struggle with that still sometimes, to interpret what silence in a response can mean, because it can be many things. And that's something you have to get used to a bit.
Right. Yeah. And all those things, there's a word, kukyoyom, reading the air.
Yes. That, I love that. I love that. Because I do feel that a lot of people in Japan can read the air very well. And I miss that when I'm outside of Japan, because they're also more in tune with not wanting to bother others. So in a public sphere, things function extremely well, because there is that feeling of not disturbing others, whether on the subway, people are not loud, you know, things like that. And that also feeds into the group mentality, which is very different from ours, or the one in the West in general, which is more of the individual.
Right.
So that's another topic. But all of this fits into the book, and that's why it's much more than a book about food. It's about all of these things.
Right. Yeah. So, okay. So we'll have a break here. And then after that, we're going to discuss all those individual chefs in the book.
With pleasure.
Yeah. So listeners, please stay with us.
Thank you.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's unique store in Lower Manhattan is home to perhaps the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan, plus the rarest natural sharpening stones and exquisitely designed tableware. They also host special events such as knife sharpening demonstrations and parties with New York's most famous chefs and restaurateurs. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the implicit and elegance of Japanese culture to your table, be it in your home or in the finest restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats Podcast live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, and my guest today is Andrea Vazzari, who is a Tokyo-based photographer in travel, portraiture, and the culinary world. And she just published a fascinating book called Tokyo New Wave, 31 Chefs Defining Japan's Next Generation, from 10 Speed Press. So let's talk about the chefs.
Sure.
So first of all, I was interested in Chef Hiroyasu Kawate of Foliage. And using the book, Kawate's food French fusion, or Japanese French.
I wouldn't call it either one.
Yeah. so you say I don't.
No.
And that would be limit the breadth and the sense of his cuisine.
It would.
Right. So can you detail what you mean by that?
Kawate-san is very talented. I go to his restaurant perhaps at least once a month. When I arrived the first time, I had this feeling that sort of overtook me of being in a place that was so different and unique than other restaurants I had experienced until then. He did spend a year in France. However, his dishes to me are not French. He uses some French techniques to cook, but he also uses many others, and he uses all Japanese ingredients. Mm. He is someone who's very linked to the land. I mean, he can talk to you about the farmers and the products for hours. And he's someone who has a very sophisticated, urbane-looking restaurant that is extremely open, and it's rather large for Tokyo, and it's stylish. But he's someone who loves wearing flip-flops and, you know, getting dirty, and he loves to walk barefoot in the dirt. And he's very refreshing because he is incredibly energetic, incredibly enthusiastic about what he does. And it's so organic for him. And his style of plating is very minimalistic. He uses these gorgeous ceramics, which also reeled me in immediately. And I went to visit his ceramicist, who lives on the outskirts of Tokyo. And I just found that everything had so much feeling. Everything felt so profound. Every detail had an intention, and it was to convey a sense of place and to convey the farmers who he respects so much. And I left feeling dazzled. I felt nourished beyond the food itself.
Wow.
And it's the aesthetics, the plating, and also his flavors, because he can cook things in such a perfect manner.
Mm.
Everything that I ate, I found was perfectly done as far as the, like the game or the meat or the fish or the vegetables. Very clean. Nothing was dry ever. Everything was moist. Everything was so well thought out. And also his use of color and texture is just very unique and beautiful.
Interesting. And I also heard he worked under Shuzo Kishida, who's from Kante-san,
yes,
which is very fine dining.
Yes.
And Kishida-san himself trained at, you know, Pascal, the
yes,
French restaurants, right?
Yes.
And then the other chef he worked for was the Bourguignon, which like Chef Kikuchi is known for, like really gutsy, you know. So like, he sounds like he really combined those different schools of
food. He did. Those have influenced him in addition to his own sort of essence, which comes across. It's not every day when you go to a restaurant that you can get a clear sense of the chef. It's not always the case. It just isn't,
right,
to me anyway. And when you go to Florilège, it comes through crystal clear.
Wow.
And I just felt excited by what he gives me when I go, so I continue to go.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. So next time, I'll give you a call and
okay,
we can go together.
Sounds good.
Okay, so how about the Takashi Sugita of Nihonbashi Kakigara Cho Sugita?
Yes. I wanted to mention him because I go for sushi. He's a sushi master, a sushi shokunin, and I go for sushi very rarely. I go once every 10 months to a year.
Mm.
And when I go to some very special, special, special sushi chefs. Sugita is one of them. He is a chef with great soul, I would say.
Mm.
My experience there, which was, first of all, it was very difficult to secure a seat. I went with a chef friend of mine from Kyoto, actually, who was delighted to go. He's from Kyoto. He couldn't get a booking. So we went together, and I was literally moved by my experience at Sugita. And it's because, again, like Kawate-san in a way, you sense who he is. Now, Sugita-san lives and works by the principles of the samurai or the warrior, and it's called Bushido.
Mm.
And you feel it when he comes out to greet all of the guests at the beginning of the meal. In his geta, you hear the click, click, click on the floor, and he comes out. And he, combined with his kind face, which you'll see in the book, he comes across as someone who is so solid and so devout to his craft, and someone who is a steady, very steady emotionally. You know, his personality is extremely strong and steady. And his technique is so beautiful with his knives. Mm. And of course, the presentation, the flavors with the fish. And when I went to say goodbye to him at the end of the meal, and I bowed and I started to cry.
Wow.
I was so moved by it. That does not happen every day.
Mm.
And he wasn't startled, but he was taken a little bit aback.
Mm.
And then he very much realized what was happening and appreciated it, because he touched something within me that was, again, going back to what we said at the beginning, that authenticity, that sense of place, and something so beautiful and unique to Japan. Because what he gives you, you will not find outside of Japan. You will not. You just can't, because it's all the details that you find when you're there.
Mm. Right. So I think I did some research, and he's known for his spirit of hospitality. Omotenashi.
Yes. And
he does the source of that perfection.
Mm. Yes.
Right.
Absolutely. Mm. He's special. He's more traditional than some of the others in the book. But still part of this generation.
Right. Mm. Okay. So I was like 31 chefs. I have to pick some, but
just a few. Yeah.
What about Koji Koizumi of Kohaku?
Yes, he's interesting. He's only 35. He may be 36 at this moment. He's very young. He's doing kaiseki. And his restaurant is gorgeous inside. It feels like an art gallery. And I think that his spirit is very uniquely Japanese, because when he cooks, he talks to me about 24 seasons, which are his point of reference. Mm. There are even more seasons than that, apparently, but these are the 24 micro seasons which dictate how he cooks, what he cooks, when he cooks. And he talked to me about the spirit of community which surrounds what he does, the potters, the purveyors. And his restaurant is extremely forward-thinking in a way, because he's bringing kaiseki into the next century, if that's possible. I mean, we're still toward the beginning of this century, but I see the future of kaiseki when I dine at Kohaku.
That's interesting.
Yes, because it doesn't feel like his mentors. I've been to Ishikawa's restaurant. It doesn't feel the same. Mm. His is more, he also uses ingredients from all over the world, not just Japanese. And his philosophy somehow imparts a unique take on kaiseki, which is fascinating, and it's quite sophisticated, his restaurant.
Mm. So not just ingredients, but style-wise?
Style, absolutely. The physical space, when you enter, you know you're not in the most traditional of kaiseki restaurants, that this is someone who's doing something a bit different, but still very tied to the tradition.
Right. Interesting. Mm. Right. So kaiseki is known to be not changing, although I think Kyoto Kaiseki Chefs are really trying to advance in their own way.
I think there are some chefs in Tokyo that are advancing it. That's why it's different and it's fresh and it's exciting to go to his restaurant. I mean, it's beautiful to go to the very traditional ones as well. I mean, there's nothing more stunning than a kaiseki experience. But Kohaku, again, the pottery, all the details that come together, how you're greeted, the other staff that works there, what they're wearing. I mean, all of these details make your experience.
Right.
And so when I talk to him, you can read the chapter, but I reference another artist when I talk about him, which I think is a very interesting way to illustrate who Koizumi is.
Right. Mm. Okay. As far as, I think essence of kaiseki is seasonality.
Yes.
So as far as it's there, it's kaiseki regardless.
Yes, right? Absolutely.
Right. And it has to make sense, and sounds like he's a person I should look for.
Yes, you should.
Right. And one other chef I was really curious, you know, Toshifumi Nakahigashi, and his brother came to the show.
Ah, yes, he works with Oda-san, no? At Kajitsu.
Yeah, used to. Right.
Yes.
So, and you know, his brother is doing, Toshifumi-san's brother is, Atsushi came to the show and he's doing Japanese. And Toshifumi-san in Tokyo, he is doing Italian,
yes, with a Japanese flair.
And his father, and both their father is really interesting.
Yes.
Like forager / chef in Kyoto.
Yes. And I went to Nakahigashi, to his father's restaurant in Kyoto. I went in December.
Wow.
And it was stunning. It was very beautiful. And he's funny. He has a great sense of humor. But Toshifumi-san in Tokyo, he forages. He forages most days. Early in the morning, you'll find him in the outskirts of Tokyo foraging for vegetables and interesting things. So he's very much a forager. He's lovely. He's such a joyous person. I love speaking to him. And we speak in Italian. He lived in Italy, and he's charming. And his restaurant is also very charming. It's very small and tones of gray and teal blue and white. It's very stylish. I like it with these hanging lights. You can see a photo of it in the book.
Right.
And he is in love with Italy. And so his dishes are extremely creative because he also has this Japanese flair. And so he is a good example of what's happening in Tokyo, I do believe.
It's a nice overlap, right? Because Italian cuisine and Japanese cuisine tend to be simpler approach to ingredients, ingredients-based and more directly from like fewer the better.
Yes. You don't want it to be too bogged down with too many different flavors, and you want to respect the ingredients. And I talk about that in my introduction to Toshifumi-san. We talked at length about the compatibility of Italian and Japanese cuisine. It was a very interesting time with him. I enjoy his company.
Right. Okay. So that's another place I have to go.
Yeah. Interesting.
Right. So, yeah, I can keep talking about more chefs, but let's talk about, you told me about you're planning to have some collaboration dinner after you go back
to
Japan.
Yes. I've planned a series of approximately 8 collaboration dinners that will begin on April 6th in Tokyo. And I paired chefs from the book together to cook for the first time together for a dinner in which each guest will receive a copy of the book. And then I think it will make for a very interesting week or more of dinner events with food and dishes which have never been tried or tasted before.
Right. So will you randomly pick and choose which chef
to work together? I just had a feeling. I thought, well, I picked a chef and thought, I really would like him to do a dinner. Who could I match him with? And then I was looking at the list and thinking, and again, so much of what I do is about feeling. So I would then propose to the chef, what do you think of doing a dinner with so-and-so? What do you like that idea? Are you friendly? Do you know each other? You know, ask those basic questions. And so far, everyone except one said yes. So they think it's an interesting opportunity. And many of these chefs are, I think, curious and interested in new experiences with other chefs in Tokyo.
I think in the States, it's more common to have collaboration dinners. But in Japan, I think, first of all, the food industry tend to be more secretive. And then now younger generations and new age chefs,
they're doing a lot, to tell you the truth. Like Zayu-san, Den, he does a lot. Kawate-san does a lot. They love to work with chefs from abroad and also within Japan. I think it's becoming more common. So I'm really excited to see what comes of it.
Do you have any example, good example of the pairing of different types of chefs?
Yes, I chose Nakahara-san, who's a yakiniku chef, to do a collaboration with Takazawa-san, who is a molecular gastronomy chef. And so we're going to see what comes out of that.
And you told me also, it's not just first course chef A, second course chef B. It's like one dish
integrated
by two chefs.
Yes, it's integration, large part. I mean, some chefs might do a couple separate, but most of them have said that they'd like to come up with original dishes. So it's exciting. It's very different.
Right. Okay, so where can we find that information if our listeners want to participate?
Well, I'm going to be posting on my Instagram, which is at Tokyo_new_wave. If you just put in Tokyo New Wave, you'll find it. We're going to be announcing on there, and then the chefs themselves will post, and I'll start posting announcements approximately a month before, so soon I'll be posting the announcements. And at TokyoNewWave.com, I have also information about sweepstakes that we're doing, which is very exciting. Win a trip to Tokyo.
Wow.
With All Nippon Airways.
Yay. Oh,
and,
wow.
Yes, and the Four Seasons Hotel, Tokyo.
Nice.
Yes, so that just launched today.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, listeners, you have to rush.
Yeah, so that's exciting too.
Great. So what's your plan? You're going to stay in Tokyo a while? Or?
I would like to, yes. I'm happy there, and it's super interesting. And I'm happy there, you know, for now. We'll see what happens. I am a wandering spirit, but I think it's infinitely interesting in Japan.
Okay, so to see update, should we just follow Tokyo New Wave?
Yes, you can follow Tokyo New Wave on Instagram, and you can check out TokyoNewWave.com. Yes.
Okay, great. And the listeners, the book is really fascinating and very insightful.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, so I highly recommend that you're going to check it out. So it's going to come be released on March 13th.
Right.
in the States.
Globally.
Globally.
Yes, it's available all over the world.
You have to have a big celebration.
Yes, it's true.
Right. Okay, so thank you for joining us today, Andrea.
Thank you so much. I loved it.
So hopefully you can come back.
I would love that.
So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or show guests, please let us know. You can email us japanneeds@theheritageradionetwork.org or akikatema.com. And Japan Needs is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. And our engineer today was Peter Harsh. And thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Ever wonder what kind of podcast Julia Child would have made? Probably would have been one where she introduced you to all of her latest discoveries and favorite people. And that's exactly the tradition we're following on Inside Julia's Kitchen, a podcast of the Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts. Join me, Todd Shulkin, your host, and the Foundation's Executive Director, as I bring you inside the Foundation's world to meet the bright lights of today's food universe, just as Julia used to do from her own famous kitchen. New episodes air on Heritage Radio Network Wednesdays at noon Eastern. Listen in.